Support for WPR comes from Worm Farm Institute with the Farm Art Detour, where artists explore the timeless connection between land and people, October 5th through the 14th. Details are at wormfarminstitute.org.
Astronomy, the stars. That's what we're going to be talking about to begin the show today. Larry Wheeler here. Great to have you along today on Wisconsin Public Radio News. We are going to be talking about the stars and astronomy with Paul Kinzer. It's great to have him back in the studio. He's the author of Stargazing Basics, Getting Started in Recreational Astronomy. He's a member of the La Crosse Area Astronomy Club. And you know what? I opened my copy of the Washington Post this morning, and the first title I saw was Why This Fall Will Be a Magnificent Time to Gaze into the Night Sky. So I think we had a perfect day to be talking with Paul. And you may have some questions as we move along today. I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Paul Kinzer, good to have you back.
Yeah, I always love coming. It's great to be here.
I tell you what, fall's kind of a great time to be looking up to the sky, isn't it?
It sure is. In the summer, especially right at the peak of summer, it's only dark where we live for a few hours each night. Yeah. And now the nights are getting longer. In fact, I heard today on the radio that today is about the first day where we're really getting less sun than nighttime by 1 minute.
And it's also the air.
Yes.
It seems crisper somehow.
Exactly. The humidity, the dew points. Just in this last week, I felt like, wait, is summer lasting forever now? But now, looking at the dew points, they're getting back down into the 50s, even into the 40s. And when the dew points are lower, the air is drier and crisper, and the stars are brighter.
Yeah, they really are. And the downside for me is that I'm one of these guys that gets up early in the morning to do my jog.
And I don't get that.
So I kind of lose, 5:30 in the morning. I've got some sky, dark sky, but that's going to be less and less once daylight savings.
Right, that's true.
When we fall back.
But of course, the sun still will be coming up later and later. And you bring that up early morning. Right now, if you get up early morning and you look to the east, maybe not here in the Madison area, you need dark skies, but maybe with binoculars you could see this. There's a comet in the sky. And that comet, it's very difficult to kind of explain what comets do. They go around the sun, they get brighter as they do. But this comet in mid-October, instead of being up early, early morning, you have to get up about an hour before sunrise right now. But it will be in the evening sky then. And it could become bright enough to see with just your eyes.
That's A3, is it? Comet
it's,
A3?
Let me look here. I have so many notes. It's called T. Coronae Borealis, but that's kind of a mouthful. TCRB, people are calling it.
TCRB.
No, that's totally wrong. That's the other thing that's going to appear soon.
Comet A3 is what
Yeah. That's kind of what people are calling it, Comet A3. Sorry about that, folks. And it was discovered last year, and it was quite bright for how far it was away when it was discovered. And what often happens with comets is you get a lot of hype. There was a story just last week saying, it's the comet of the century. And I'm like, how do you know? The century's got a long way to go yet, for one thing. But it could be the comet of the year, maybe the comet of the decade. And comets, their brightness is really hard to predict. When it got as close as it was going to get to the sun, often what happens is comets burn up then. They're mostly made of ice. This one made it past. And now it's going away from the sun and getting dimmer as it does. But at the same time, it's getting closer to Earth. It's not going to hit us or anything like that. But as it gets closer to Earth, it will get brighter in our skies. So I'm really looking forward to it from about
the middle of October?
Yeah, the 14th to the 24th. Then you would want to look in the west, after the sun goes down.
Well, I'm thinking back to the comets I've seen in my life, and there have been some dandies.
Oh, yeah, yes.
I'm thinking back. The 90s, we had, which one was it?
There were two of them, actually. Comet Hyakutake.
Yeah.
It wasn't as bright, but its tail spanned half the sky. And then there was Comet Hale-Bopp.
Hale-Bopp was the one I remember.
Yeah. I have a picture of my nieces. They're very young girls then, right in the middle of Minneapolis. And it wasn't even dark yet, and it was plain as anything. It was phenomenal. And you could see it for months.
Yeah, yeah. It was really something. I remember watching it out the window early one morning. Yeah. And it was getting light, but you could still see it very, very plainly. Well, we're not going to have that with Comet A3, probably. But.
Oh, no, no. And yet, there are predictions it could get bright enough to see during the day. There are people... scientists working on that. But again, there's no way to know until it actually happens.
In the coming months, there's a number of events I think we can see without a telescope. And we'll talk about telescopes and binoculars for sure. I know you brought one, a binocular. So let's start with meteor showers.
Yeah, meteors. People, not just kids, have a real misconception. What's a meteor? It's a shooting star. They have nothing to do with stars. A meteor is usually something the size of a grain of sand to a small rock, and they're going through space, left behind usually by comets. As comets go towards the sun, they're made, people call them dirty snowballs. They're made of ice and rock, and as they melt, coming near the sun, bits of them get left behind. That's what their tails are, and every once in a while, we go through one of those debris fields left behind by a comet. When the Earth, going around the sun at a very fast speed, I mean, we're going thousands of miles per hour, and the rocks are often going in the opposite direction. When they hit our air, they heat up and they burn up and they leave a streak of light across the sky. It can take, you know, far less than a second, up to several seconds, a really big one, maybe. Every once in a while, there's one the size of, say, a bus, a school bus. They even explode. There was one over Russia in 2013, over a fair-sized city, and luckily it came in at a really shallow angle. If it would have been coming straight down, I really think maybe a million people would have been killed.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. It blew up and knocked out thousands of windows, but it blew up in the atmosphere.
Man, Paul Kinzer, our guest today, author of Stargazing Basics, talking with him about astronomy, questions or comments, or maybe an experience to share. I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Got one coming. It'll be later into winter, and the Geminid.
Right. The Geminid meteor shower. It's going to peak this year on December 13th and 14th. The thing about meteor showers is that's when we pass through one of these debris fields. I don't know if I was clear on that. You can see meteors almost any night. There's just stuff out there, and you go, oh, look, a shooting star. I saw one last Tuesday, a nice bright one. But when we have meteor showers, we can see dozens per hour. Unfortunately, this year, the Geminid meteor shower, there's going to be a nearly full moon in the sky when it peaks, the shower peaks, but the shower lasts for weeks. So if you go out nights before or nights after that full moon, you're likely to see things. As with anything astronomical, the further you get from artificial light, the better. So if you can get away from town, I live in a little tiny town, Galesville, 1,600 people. It's pretty dark there. I can see the Milky Way from my backyard. But if you can't, you can still see meteors. You're just not going to see the dimmer ones.
The Geminids, yeah, I'll be in northern Wisconsin, far north, like the end of November.
I believe it's starting around then. But even if it's not, the weird thing is there are way more meteor showers we know about now than we used to. And the reason is digital cameras. People have digital video cameras that are on all the time now. And folks started noticing, hey, there's more meteors during this time than other times. And they all seem to be coming from this one direction. They're called the Geminids because it seems as though they're coming out of the constellation Gemini or from that direction. They're not necessarily. It's just where we are in our orbit and where they are in theirs and how we plow through them. But yeah, there are lots of them going on now almost all the time, you know, but there are nights where instead of seeing maybe one meteor every hour or two, you might see five every hour. It's always a fun thing to do. And that's not only you don't need binoculars or a telescope, you don't want them because you can't tell where in the sky a meteor is going to appear. And they only last a fraction of a second usually.
I can remember being in that northern Mayfield County in November, and just, you know, and there's no lights.
Yeah, yeah.
You're out next to the Shawamigan National Forest.
That's right, that's right. More and more parks and things, too, are hyping and trying to protect their dark skies. It's part of our heritage. And sadly, because of light pollution, we're losing that. So getting out to those places that are undeveloped and protected, one of the things to always remember is, you know, you might fish, you might hunt, you might go looking for birds, but if you're there at night, look up.
Yeah, look up for sure. Speaking of looking up, I've noticed on Facebook, on my Facebook page, I've had friends who are north, far north Wisconsin or into Canada, sending wonderful photos of northern lights.
Yeah, and that's, I'll talk about them in a minute, but that's another thing that technology has made a difference. The latest phones have amazing cameras in them now that actually, if there are northern lights going on, you can barely see them with your eye. Well, you take a picture with your phone, they can see light that our eyes can't. So some of those pictures that I've seen, I'm like, well, I saw those northern lights, but it was nothing like that. And Larry, I still don't own a smartphone, so I can't take them myself. But yeah, right now, this is another really nice thing about the sky right now is the sun is at its peak activity. The sun has an 11-year cycle, and at the peak of that cycle, if you're able to look at the sun, and of course only do that with proper eye protection, but if you can, right now there are almost always sun spots, dark spots on the sun, and those are solar storms. There's no rain or water involved, but they're magnetic and electrical and very complicated and weird, and every once in a while one of them spits some stuff off the sun, some material off the sun, and a day or two later, or three, they hit the Earth's atmosphere, and they cause the northern lights. They cause atoms up in our upper atmosphere to split, and when they come back together, they give off light, and they can be red or green. It depends on which atoms had been smacked apart, and we don't need to go into that, but they're gorgeous. And we've had some really nice ones this year. And again, the phones are showing them, and I hope getting people to go out and look more.
And again, the light makes a, I mean, if you've got light, you have.
Yeah. We can see stuff from my backyard, but there's a couple of streetlights. It's like, does anyone really need this? Light pollution is sad. We light up the night in ways we don't need to. Yeah. Again, when I was a kid, I lived in St. Paul, Minnesota. It was a big enough city. I could see a lot of stars. We had streetlights, and they made it light enough to walk. Now it seems like we want to make it as bright as day. Because we can. I wish we would get over that, and a lot of people are. Yeah. There are lighting solutions now that more and more people and cities and states even are taking part in.
Well, and direct the light down.
That's right. It's not hard. There's a place, they've changed their name. They were called the International Dark Sky Association. Now they might just be called Dark Skies International or something like that. And I'm even a member. But anyway, they work around the world to try and defeat light pollution, because again, the stars are our legacy, and not being able to see them doesn't need to happen. So,
Paul Kinzer, our guest, author of Stargazing Basics, Getting Started in Recreational Astronomy. Questions for him? Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at the night sky and the stars in the sky, night or day, with our guest today, Paul Kinzer, author of Stargazing Basics. Question for him, again, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org. In relationship to what we were just talking about, Paul, Megan in Black Creek emailed to say they just returned from vacation out west where they camped at some international dark sky places. The Milky Way was seen immediately upon going outside shortly after sunset. Megan looked up international dark sky in Wisconsin and only found Door County to have a dark sky spot.
Mm-hmm.
What can we do as a community to darken our skies? Is there a movement for Wisconsin to have darker skies?
Well, again, the International Dark Skies Association, they have packets that you can present to your local or county boards to show, here's what we can do to darken our skies. My little town, they installed what's called full cutoff streetlights that do mostly shine down. And that made a huge difference. And that's something that's, you know, you can download those packets for free. Go to your local meetings and talk about it. Years ago, they built a new middle school in my town. And before I ended up being on the school board, but before I was, I approached the school saying, hey, now that you're building this, can we please have lights in the parking lot that shine down? And that can be turned off and that aren't on all night. And that's what they did. So, you know,
good for you.
It was right on the edge of town and it would have been a real literal bright spot, but it doesn't have to be. You know, how many people need the parking lot lit up at 3 a.m?
Yeah, no, hardly anybody.
Yeah,
hardly anybody for sure. I want to talk about the moon, but I also, you brought some binoculars.
Yeah.
Talk about what you brought.
I brought binoculars that I bought a few years ago. There's a story behind that. I had a pair I really liked, and we left them in a bathroom at a national park. And so I wanted to get new ones, and I did. And they're Nikon, and typically these cost a couple of $100, but I won't do that. So I got them on sale for $100. These are excellent birding binoculars, or just, you know, whatever you want to use binoculars for. And then they're also excellent astronomy binoculars. The numbers on this are 10 by 50. And that's how binoculars are labeled. There might be 7 by 35 or 8 by 42. The numbers mean 10. The 10 means that's how much it magnifies. It makes things look 10 times bigger. And the 50 is the diameter of the lens on the front of the binoculars. The bigger that number, the more light that gets in. So you want, for astronomy, you want that number to be pretty big. You can get little binoculars, you know, that are much more portable, but they're not going to show you as much at night. But any binoculars will show you way more than your eyes can see on their own. A typical pair of binoculars, if you use just your eyes at night, you can see a couple thousand stars. If you use binoculars, you can see more than 100,000 stars. So they really make a difference. And again, for me, these are good, 10 by 50. Anything bigger than that, they're kind of hard to hold in your hands.
Yeah.
And also, if your hands shake, and they will a little bit, no matter what, the more you magnify, the more that shake is also magnified. So 10 by 50 is good for a kind of big guy like me. 7 by 35 is also a great choice. And the one reason you might notice the ratio there, 50 divided by 10 is 5, 35 divided by 7 is 5. That number 5 is how big the little spot of light is that hits your eye.
Oh.
And at night, our eyes, the pupil in our eyes, expand to about 5 millimeters. So it's a perfect use of what you have. Now, kids are lucky. They have sort of superpowers. They get used to the dark faster than old guys like us or even any adults. And their pupil gets a little bigger, but not a lot bigger. So, yeah, 10 by 50s are great. 7 by 35s are also excellent. And they're way lighter.
Yeah. Trevor in Viroqua, we'll give you a chance to join in. Thanks for calling.
Hey, yeah, I have a 8-inch Dobsonian-mounted SkyQuest telescope reflector.
Great.
And when I look at the moon through it, through the lenses, it part of the moon's edge is orange, and the opposite side is blue. And I was just curious where that's coming from. I also notice when I look at, like, pool lines on the bottom of a pool, those lines can also be orange on one side and blue on the other. So I'm just curious where that light is coming from.
Yeah, I kind of am too, because reflector telescopes, that's kind of what they're known for. They don't show those edges. I would maybe need to know more about the eyepieces you're using and stuff, and I don't know that we have time for that. It could also be that possibly your mirrors are not perfectly perpendicular to the line of sight. Maybe they're both turned a little bit, and that's causing a prismatic effect. I'm not really an optics expert. A reflector telescope usually doesn't do that.
What would Trevor, I mean, is there some place you could, Trevor or anybody else could go to say, here's my telescope. Are the mirrors positioned?
Yeah, where is Trevor calling from?
From Viroqua.
Oh, well, you should check out your area astronomy clubs. I know there's an observatory at Wyalusing State Park, and there is an astronomy club in that area. Maybe you're even aware of it. There are experts there that if you bring it to them, I bet within 5 minutes they'll go, well, here's your problem. They'll be able to solve that for you, and they'll want to, because people join astronomy clubs because they love the sky, and they love to share the sky. So, yeah, and almost anywhere you are in Wisconsin or elsewhere, you're within not too far from an astronomy club. Call a local branch of the university or other colleges. Museums, zoos even might have some recommendations for folks. But yeah, there's somebody out there not too far from you.
Yeah. Trevor, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it.
Sorry, I can't be more help.
Jim emailed to ask, where does the name Shakinshin Atlas originate for Comet A3. Jim said they're aware the comet was found by a lab group called Atlas, but what about, and the spelling is T-S-U-C-H-I-N-S-H-A-N, which is why I was having trouble.
Right, and which is why I didn't say it. that is a Chinese word, and I'm I don't recall right now. I think it's an individual, but I might be wrong. Comets are named for whoever discovers them. They're about the only thing that is. People might think otherwise, but you don't get planets named after you. and meteors don't last. But comets get named for their discoverers. And there's another comet with that name that was discovered in 1965. So I don't know if this is an organization or an individual, but that's how they're named. Like Comet Hale-Bopp was named for Mr. or Ms. Bopp and a Mr. Hale, because they both kind of found it around the same time. And there are folks all the time, that's what they do. They're out there looking. I can't remember his name, but his last name is Levy. And he's found many, many comets. Comet Shoemaker Levy 9 that ran into Jupiter in 1994. He was a co-discoverer of that. Now, how cool would that be? It left spots on Jupiter for weeks. So, yeah, I'm sure if you look on Google, it'll tell you who that person, however you say it, is.
All right. I love the name Hale-Bopp.
Yeah. Yes.
Was just a perfect.
Yeah, it sure was.
Not Bob Hale. Hale Bob.
Hale Bob.
Hale Bob.
Just saying it. Yeah.
It's the perfect one.
Yeah.
Well, somebody else had a question about moons, and I've lost that. But here, the people know a full moon or a new moon when they see it, but there's also a super moon and, on the other end, a micro moon.
Yeah, sure there is. The supermoon idea was made up by somebody to get clicks. The moon, it orbits the Earth, but it doesn't go around us in a circle. It goes around us in an ellipse. And there are some times when it's a bit closer to the Earth and other times when it's a bit farther away. Sometimes it's close to us when the moon is full. When it is at its closest for that year during a full moon, originally, that was the supermoon, the biggest moon, biggest full moon of the year. Not a whole lot bigger. And in fact, I would challenge anyone to go look at a supermoon and be able to tell that it's any bigger. Now, you might say, oh, I can tell because you want to, but it doesn't mean it's true. And the micromoon was invented later, and it's the smallest full moon of the year. But here's the thing. Last month, I saw an article. This year, there will be 4 supermoons. What does that mean? That's all it means. It means the biggest full moon of the year. And it is brighter. It is bigger. But if you see 2 photos, like if you took a photo of the supermoon of the year and then the micromoon, yeah, you'd be able to see, oh, yeah, that one's bigger. But to see it with your eye, maybe I shouldn't say anything, though, because if people get out and look at the moon, that's great. I will tell you, though, the full moon is the worst time to look at the moon because it's high noon there. The shadows on the crater edges, they're gone. If you're out there when the moon isn't full and you look right at that line between night and day on the moon called the terminator, you look with binoculars or a telescope, you'll be able to see way more detail than during the full moon. Also, the full moon washes out the light of the stars, so it's not a good night to look at anything else up there either.
Yeah, that's the trouble when you have, you know, like for meteor showers, if you've got a full moon.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But the supermoons, I read, where was it? October 17th and November 15th.
Yeah.
The second and third, quote-unquote, supermoon of this year.
And isn't it sad that this October one is going to be right when the comet is at its brightest? Why, I ought to. But you know, I shouldn't complain about the moon because it's beautiful, and it gets us out at night, and it gets us looking up, and it got people thinking about what the heck is up there.
Yeah.
So I love looking at the moon, not so much the full moon, but I like looking at the moon. With binoculars, you can see detail. You can see the things that people named seas. They used to think those dark areas were water. And then someone looked at them with a telescope when they were invented and said, there's a crater in the middle of that ocean. I don't think that's water. So, yeah, it's a cool thing to look at.
Laurel in Coleman has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Laurel.
Hi. I have been always wondering, our Earth rotates around and around or oblong, wherever it goes. Does the air that's around the Earth follow the globe or our Earth, or does it stay still and we just keep rotating?
Well, that's what causes most of our weather. As the Earth spins, the air doesn't quite keep up, and that causes wind. And if you were to look up trade winds and other winds, you would see that they go in general directions, depending on if you're right by the equator, north of the equator, south of the equator. And if you look at maps, say, or a satellite photo that shows a hurricane, you can see that it spins. And it spins because the Earth is bigger towards the equator, and it's smaller further north. So the Earth, the ground is moving faster at the equator than it is at the poles. In fact, it's barely moving at all at the poles. It takes 24 hours to spin around. But at the equator, the Earth is moving more than 1,000 miles an hour. So yes, it definitely has an effect. The air does not just turn. It does turn. Gravity holds on to it. But it doesn't go quite as fast as the ground.
And that's why we have the hurricanes in...
Right. And that's why storms in the northern hemisphere spin in one direction And in the southern hemisphere, they spin in the other direction. But your toilet water does not go down in a different direction. That's a scam and a myth. So,
Laurel, that was a great question.
Yeah, it was. That was an excellent question. Thank you.
Thank you very much for calling. Jeff in La Crosse emailed with a couple of questions about the TCB Nova. Mm. First, Jeff believes the location has been moving from overhead earlier in the year when it might have appeared to now, just above the western horizon.
Right.
At what point will it be impossible for Jeff to see here in La Crosse?
I did some research on the star, but that I did not research. And what he's talking about is a star that's about to go nova, not supernova. It's not going to disappear. It's a people call it the blaze star, and it is a star that people noticed a couple of hundred years ago. It suddenly became bright. Usually, it's so dim you can barely see it in binoculars. But it seems every 80 years it bursts into brightness and becomes easily visible to the naked eye. And I just read it's one of the 120 brightest stars. And the reason it happens is because it's actually two stars. One is called a white dwarf. People say it's like a dead star. It's what's left over after a star kind of puffs itself away, or sometimes it's even left after a supernova. It's a little ball about the size of the Earth, but with the mass of the sun. So it's got really powerful gravity. Then there's another star in this system, and it's a big red star. And a little star is pulling hydrogen from the giant star. And every 80 years, so much of that hydrogen that it gathers on itself goes there that it blows up. Oh. And it's supposed to become visible in our skies. The newest prediction is next month, October. One more reason to look up. I wish I knew. I don't have a star chart in front of me. If you download a free program called Stellarium, you can get it on your phone. And I know, Larry, there are apps you can get for your phone, too. Stellarium is a full planetarium software program, and it's free. You can get it for your computer, too. And then you can just put the date, the time, anytime from 10,000 years ago to 10,000 years from now. And it'll show you what the sky looks like. And you can also put your location or any location, not just on the Earth, but even on other planets. So it's a very cool thing, and it will show you exactly where that star. It's in the constellation, the Northern Crown, Corona Borealis. I didn't realize that it was that low. I thought it was still okay in our sky. But, of course, it will be going away as we go around the sun. Certain constellations get lower and lower every night until they're washed out and they're out during the day. So, yeah.
And that one, if it'll go away, but will it reappear at some point? Is what Jeff's wondering.
Yeah, it in 80 years.
Oh well.
once it bursts, and again, their best prediction is it will be in the next month or so, and they know that by studying its change. It's little bits of change in brightness and compare them to 80 years ago, right before it burst, and we could see it really well. And when it does burst, we'll be able to see it with our naked eyes for a few days and binoculars maybe a little bit longer, and then it'll fade away again for 80 years.
Really cool. Jupiter is rising earlier each night.
That's right. Jupiter is. Saturn is up right now, right when it gets dark. And it will be till the end of the year. But Jupiter is rising earlier every night. It's going to reach what we call opposition. It's closest distance to the Earth because it's on the exact opposite side of the sun from us. So it's highest at midnight, and it's up all night. And that's in a month or two. But right now, if you go outside, not too long after it gets dark, Jupiter will be coming up. And again, Jupiter is a wonderful thing to look at in binoculars. Instead of looking like a star, you can actually tell it's a little ball. And you can't do that with any star. They're so far away that even the biggest telescopes in the world can't really see anything more than a point of light when they look at a star. Yeah, it's a few stars they can, but not many. But Jupiter, you can see it looks like a ball. And even through small binoculars, you can see four of its moons.
It has like 95 moons.
95 moons. And Saturn has over 150. So they used to compete, but it seems like that's done. And in a way, the rings of Saturn, it's made up of gazillions of little things. Are they moons? I don't know. So, yeah. But both of them are in the evening sky, another reason to look up. Through binoculars, Saturn won't show you much. You might be able to tell that it's not round, but not much more.
Might be able to see those moons of Jupiter.
Of Jupiter, you definitely can. I forgot to look, but I'm wondering, the largest moon in the solar system is Titan. And I hope I'm not wrong, it's a moon of Saturn. And it's so big, it has an atmosphere. And we are sending, or we're working on it anyway, a helicopter to Titan. Think about that.
Wow.
Now, the atmosphere there, it isn't oxygen and nitrogen like ours, but who cares? It's air, in a way. You can fly airplanes and helicopters in it. Its atmosphere is thicker than Earth's, and its gravity is like 1/8 of Earth's, or some, I don't know, 1/5, something like that. It's way less than ours. Oh, yeah, it's like, I think it's 18%. So flying there is way easier here. So that's the plan. And then there's also people are like, we ought to send boats and submarines there too, because there's lakes and seas. And I was like, yeah, let's do it.
Dot in Manitowoc has something. Well, let's go there. Hi, Dot.
Hello. Good morning. I would like to know if your guest would like to go to the moon, be an astronaut, and actually walk on the moon.
Duh. Yes, I absolutely would. I travel the state with a portable planetarium, and I do programs at schools and libraries, and I work with kids. And this year, the summer library program was Adventure Begins at Your Library. So I talked about adventures in space, and I talked about going to the moon. Neil and Buzz walked on the moon when I was 9, and I wanted to be an astronaut since the day I knew what an astronaut was. And if they said to me, Paul, would you like to go to the moon? I would just shake my head. Well, yeah. Or just, I don't know, though, that I'd want to be one of those folks who just goes up in these, you have to be a billionaire to do it, but you go up in a spacecraft, you're up there for 3 minutes, or a couple of them were up for a few days, and then you come home. It's so expensive to put people in space. I'd rather they send somebody who could actually do some science. I love science, but I'm not a professional scientist. So,
what did you think of the movie? And I'm trying to remember of the guy on Mars.
Oh, The Martian. I didn't see it, and I'm going to tell you why, because the reason that there's trouble on Mars in that movie and the book is because there's a big old storm and it causes damage. Well, there are huge dust storms on Mars, but the atmosphere is 1% of Earth's. There's no dust storm on Mars that's going to throw big rocks. It's not going to happen. And I know it was just for the movie, but I saw that and I went, that's a nope for me. No thanks. there are people who are like, hey, I love that. And that's okay. It got people into science, but
I like the movie a
yeah.
lot.
Yeah.
I thought it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I bet it was, but that's the kind of guy I am. I have a hard time with that.
Oh, man. Paul Kinzer, our guest today, author of Stargazing Basics, Getting Started in Recreational Astronomy. Questions, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you can email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Tomorrow on the Larry Mueller Show, we'll talk about buying and selling a home as our interest rates start to fall. We'll also get some advice for renters. That's tomorrow on the Larry Mueller Show. Right now, we're talking about astronomy with our guest, Paul Kinzer, author of Stargazing Basics, Getting Started in Recreational Astronomy, member of the La Crosse Area Astronomy Club as well. Questions, still time, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234 Or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I wanted to talk a little about star clusters. We've got the Pleiades, known as the cluster known as Seven Sisters.
Yeah.
What's significant about it?
It's pretty. It's beautiful. It's something that you can see also from almost everywhere in the world that has people. Because it's fairly close to the equator in the sky, so people in the south and the north can see it. And it's coming up earlier every night. Right now, it rises not too long after dark. By Halloween, it'll be high enough to see at like 8:30 or 9 in the eastern sky. What it is it's a group of stars that formed about 100 million years ago, very close to each other. And they're still pretty close to each other. So if you see it with your naked eye, people with good eyes, people unlike me, can see about 6 stars. There are people with amazing eyes who can see up to 14. But with a pair of binoculars, you can see dozens of stars, most of them a nice bright blue. And there's a little bit of a pattern to it. And it's just a gorgeous thing to look at, especially when you know that it's hundreds of light years away.
Like it's 430 light years away. Light years.
A light year is how far light travels in 1 year. People often think a light year is time because of the word year, but it's actually a distance. Light travels 186,000 miles in 1 second. It can get here from the moon in 1 1/3 seconds. Well, that means it travels almost 6 million miles in 1 year. And this star cluster is 430 light years away. And we can see it with our eyes. So when you look at it, it's cool to think those are stars like ours. And what would it be like if we lived on a planet in amongst all those stars so close together? And it took that light 400 and some years to get here. I just now had the thought, if you looked at them tonight, the light that left them just a few years before the telescope was invented. That's pretty cool to me. Yeah,
that is very cool. Bill in Hayward has a question for you. Bill, thank you for calling.
Thank you for having me. Hey, I have a question about the dark side of the moon. Is the dark side of the moon always the dark side, or is there any rotation on the moon at all?
Yes, that's a good question. The moon rotates, but it rotates in the exact or almost exact same amount of time it takes to go around the Earth. The moon goes around us once a month. It spins around once a month. What does that mean? It means that all the time, the same side is aiming at us. When there's a new moon, the dark side, people call it the dark side. The better thing to call it is the far side. We never see it here on Earth. But when we have a new moon and we can't see the moon, well, the sun is shining on the other side of the moon. It's a full moon for the far side when it's a new moon for us. And when it's a full moon for us, it's a new moon for the far side. So the far side gets just as much sun as the near side. I know it's kind of hard to imagine, but if you have two people, have one of them stand still and the other one walk in a circle around them with a light behind him. And you'll see that as he's walking around facing you, sometimes that light will hit his face, and sometimes it'll hit the back of his head.
Yeah. And we have, as long as we're on the moon, Bill, thanks a lot for calling. We had a total solar eclipse seen by millions of people. It was last April.
Oh, yeah.
And there will be an annular eclipse, which will be available, I think, South America and Antarctica, maybe?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What's an annular?
An annular eclipse. The moon, again, remember, the moon is sometimes farther from the Earth and sometimes closer. When there's a total solar eclipse, what happens is the moon, which is 400 times closer to the Earth than the sun, well, it just so happens the sun is 400 times the diameter of the moon. So they look the same size in our sky. Well, when we had the total solar eclipse back in April, which I got to see, yay, I went to Southern Illinois, then the moon was close enough to the Earth that it totally blocked the sun. during an annular eclipse. The word annular means ring. It's just like a ring on your finger. You see a ring of sunlight around the moon because the moon is so far away, it doesn't completely block the sun. So that's what an annular eclipse is.
I think they can see it. We'll be able to see it if you travel quickly to Hawaii.
Yeah, right, yeah.
And we've got hunter's moons, beaver's moons,
yeah.
And cold moon, I think, is December.
Yeah, it? And the harvest moon, to me, is one of the ones that really lives up to its name. It's more than just a name people gave it. Long ago, the harvest moon is the full moon closest to the fall equinox. And people out there harvesting their fields, yay, there's a full moon. We get some time. We can actually be out here after dark. And that's the one we just had last week. We had the harvest moon. And the cool thing about last week was there was a very, very tiny partial lunar eclipse. A little bit was shaved off the top by the Earth's shadow. And I had friends over for a campfire in our backyard. And my wife a few days later said, hey, you didn't tell us about that. And I'm like, I didn't remember it, which can happen. So
what's the next closest galaxy? We've got...
The next closest large galaxy is the Andromeda Galaxy, and it's called Andromeda because it's in the constellation Andromeda, who is famous in mythology. She's the daughter of Cepheus and Cassiopeia, but we don't need to get into that. If you... can get away from town lights. I can see this from my backyard if I know when to look. If you see Cassiopeia, she is a constellation. It looks like a big M or W. It's basically two triangles next to each other. If you use the triangle that's less flat as an arrow pointing away from the Big Dipper, look it up. You can find this. If you use that as an arrowhead with a pair of binoculars and you slide your binoculars about 2.5 diameters of that triangle away, you'll see a little fuzzy blob. And that little fuzzy blob is the center of the nearest spiral big galaxy to us. And that little fuzzy blob is tens of billions of stars. And the light hitting your eye left them 2.5 million years ago. There aren't things that I usually consider mind-blowing, but that's one. Yeah.
Well, we're starting to run out of time here, but you told me about a NASA experiment.
Oh, yeah.
That's something we can probably many of us would be able to see.
Yeah, and you may be able to look this up. I know there are sites that will tell you where certain satellites are. NASA launched something a while ago. It's an experimental solar sail. The light from the sun actually exerts some pressure. And if you have a sail big enough, made of something thin and shiny and light enough, it can get pushed by sunlight. And unlike rocket fuel that you have to take with you, sunlight's there all the time. So it would take a long time to speed you up, but you could get going really fast. Well, right now there's one up there. They unrolled this sail. It's up there right now, and they haven't turned on its little engine yet. So it's just sort of flipping around up there. And last week, I was looking up at the sky. I didn't even know about this yet. And suddenly, going across the sky, a star, it looked like a star appeared and got brighter and brighter and brighter as it moved across the sky. And then it got dimmer and dimmer and dimmer and went away. And it was the next day I found out it was that solar sail just sort of rotating around. So I hope I get to see it again. It was cool.
Well, I tell you what, it's been cool having you with us, Paul.
Yeah, I love it.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Sure.
We'll do it again with Paul Kinzer. He is the author of Stargazing Basics, Getting Started in Recreational Astronomy. It's a wonderful book, by the way. He's also a member of the La Crosse Area Astronomy Club. So great to have him with us. And there's another guy I bet spent a lot of time looking up at the stars. His name is Kerry Siegel, and he's got a book. It's called A Talk in the Woods, Voices Along the Appalachian Trail. And we'll talk with him next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Little Aaron Copeland to get us going on our next part of our program. And I think it's appropriate because brings to mind the outdoors and walking and hiking and looking, I guess. And there's a guy, Kerry Siegel, who did a lot of walking. In fact, he walked the whole Appalachian Trail, and he wrote a book about it. It's called A Talk in the Woods, Voices Along the Appalachian Trail. It's a great read, and I'm glad to have him with us today in the studio to talk about the book and to talk about the people that he met along the trail. And maybe you've thought about the Appalachian Trail and maybe hiking it, or maybe you already have done a part or all of the Appalachian Trail and you want to join in with your own thoughts and comments. Maybe you just have a question about the trail. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Kerry Siegel, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks a lot for having me on the show, Larry.
And I should have mentioned, Kerry's a former reporter and copy editor at the Wisconsin State Journal, and has done many other things as well. The book itself, published by Black Burner Books, and the Appalachian Trail, Kerry, it's almost 2,200 miles long. It passes through 14 states, I think Georgia to Maine. How did you decide to hike the trail?
Well, back when I was a student at the UW in my early 20s, I took my first backpacking trip with Hoofers. Yeah. And I knew then I'd probably want to hike the whole thing someday. And over the course of many years after that, I'd hiked several sections of it in several states. And finally, when I took a buyout from the State Journal, I decided that was a good time to do the whole thing.
And you were 64 years old when you started in late May of 2014, if I'm not mistaken. How did you know you could do it?
Well, I've been running since I was in high school, ran cross country, and I was in good shape, and I'd been running 50 to 60 miles a week. So, and I'd hiked sections of it, so I was fairly sure I was in good enough shape to do it at that time.
You started in 2014. Didn't quite make it that year, but...
Well, what happened is most people start the trail in March or April. It takes about 6 months to get to Katahdin in Maine. And I didn't start till late May because I'd run the 20-mile Sydney My race from Madison to Stoughton. At that time, I'd done it 36 years in a row. And I didn't want to break my streak.
Okay, well, I can understand that. Well, you know, you spent all those years writing and reporting and editing for the State Journal, but you didn't expect to write about hiking the trail. Is that right?
No, I'd read many books about the trail before I started, many memoirs, and they're all quite similar, most of them except for Walk in the Woods by Bill Bryson, and people write about their hike and what they eat and how far they walk and their experiences. And I didn't really think I'd have much to add. But then I started hiking it, and the first day I met a pretty interesting character. And after a couple of days when I met more, being a reporter at heart, I decided I wanted to write about the people that I met. So I started talking to pretty much everybody I met, and if they had an interesting story, I'd ask them if I could interview them, and I'd say I was a former reporter writing a book about the trail. So I mainly wrote about people, but actually a few hundred people that I met on the trail, and a little bit about me and my hike to carry the story along, to tie the stories together.
Yeah, it was. And how many did you interview? A couple hundred people? The names in the book, there's a lot of names.
Well, I've never counted them all, but I know it's more than 300
people. Oh, my goodness. Well, I wonder, did that slow down your hike?
Yeah, that's why I started what I planned to be a through hike. And that's when you start actually, the definition of a through hike is doing the whole trail within 1 year. But most people do it, start in Georgia and hike to Maine, and it takes about 6 months on the average. And I had about 5 months, but I was in good shape, so I thought I could do it. But then I started talking, interviewing people. And then after about a week, I decided I better start writing stories or I would never do it. So I stopped in a small town in North Carolina, Franklin, North Carolina, and took the day off and went to the library and wrote my first story. And then I emailed it to everybody on my email list because I figured that would get me feedback and incentive to keep going. And once I started doing it, people would ask me questions. I'd keep doing it. So I continued stopping every once in a while to write stories. And after about 1,000 miles at the north end of Shenandoah National Park, I realized I couldn't keep stopping or I'd never finish the trip.
Well, one of the people, I want to talk about some of the hikers you met on the trail because there's some fascinating people. And let's start with Warren Doyle, who wrote a really nice foreword to your book. And you call him a trail icon and a iconoclast. Why?
Well, Warren is a legend on the trail, and he's got a controversial personality, and he's really opinionated about what he believes about the trail. And he hiked it the first time when he was in college in Connecticut, and he hiked it in what was then the record time of 66 and a third day. And he became obsessed with the trail. And then he started leading groups of students on the trail. And the trail essentially became his life, although he has been a professor also. But he's hiked it 18 times. 9 times with through hikes and 9 times with section hikes. And I met him, I knew about him because there's been a lot written about Warren Doyle. Anybody that knows much about the trail knows about Warren Doyle. And I was in Vermont staying at a hostel for the night, and there were 3 women there who told me that they were on one of Warren Doyle's guided hikes. What he did was he trained groups of people how to hike the trail and on a strict schedule with day packs. And he had a van in which he carried the gear of the people. That they all had a bin. Uh-huh. And so I interviewed these 3 women at the hostel about what they knew about the hike, and then I met Warren the next morning. And so I talked to him a little bit on the trail. And then I wrote about the 3 women, and I wrote about him. And he was leading this hike with everybody donated for expenses for the hike. And they all had day packs, and they had a strict schedule of where they're going to be each day and each night. And in the morning, they all put their what they didn't need in the bins in the van. And he also had his car there. And he'd drive the van north to the end point, and then he'd hike south back to his car while everybody else was hiking north. And then he'd drive his car to the northernmost point, and that's what they did. And everything was on a strict schedule, and he did, I don't remember exactly how many times he did this, but when I met him, it was in 2015, and he's my age. Yeah. So he did one more when he was 67. But he also has what's called the Appalachian Trail Institute in northeastern Tennessee. And he gives courses on how to hike the trail. So people go to his place, and he has 5-day courses on how to hike the trail. And he also still leads maybe month-long hikes doing the same way that he calls them smart hikes. And he runs the institute out of his a 19-room farmhouse he owns, and he also has the Appalachian Folk School in the same place. So Warren Doyle is a legend on the trail, and he's basically, it's become his life.
Well, and he described you as curious and caring, competent newspaper reporter who unselfishly gave up his original goal of a through hike to cover the human side of this pilgrimage route. That must have made you feel good to see what he wrote.
And I was appreciated the fact that he even wrote a foreword. Yeah. He read the book, and he apparently liked it because he agreed to write the foreword. And and then actually in May, there's a big celebration in Damascus, Virginia called Trail Days. It draws many thousands of people to the trail every May, and he invited me to come there this May, where I gave my first little talk about the book. And he's in charge of presentations at Trail Days.
We probably don't, or maybe we do know, I doubt it, though, how many people have actually walked that trail?
If I knew you wanted that statistic, I would have looked it up. But I know today about a few thousand people start a thru hike each year. Some start in the south in Georgia. A much smaller percentage start in Maine. And some people start in the middle and then go north and then go south. People do it a variety of ways, but most start in Georgia. And about 3,000 this year, about 25% about 25% quit after the first 31 miles. Some quit. There's an approach trail to the Appalachian Trail from a state park in Georgia called Amicalola Falls, which is about 8.8 miles. And some people quit on the approach trail. And including a girlfriend I had in my early 20s, a former girlfriend in my early 20s. But about half of the people that start make it to Harper's Ferry, which is at 1,019 miles, kind of which is where the headquarters of the Appalachian Trail Conservancy is, which manages the trail for the National Park Service. And about half of those make it to Katahdin. So about 25% of the people that start a thru hike actually finish it. People that have been trained by Warren, about three-quarters of those actually finish the thru hike. And people that have gone on his guided hikes, I think all but one have finished the hike. So, but it's most people quit for one reason or another, injuries or boredom, or they just get sick of it, or they get sick. But so.
And there's we can get into the way that people walk, because there can be stops along the way, and I want to get to that. But one of your favorite stories, and kind of one of my favorite stories too in the book, had to do with what everybody has a handle, and the mama bear and the cubs. To me, I think it was Lisa Murray was from Florida, and her twin children, Tess and Cole, 3 years old when they started their hike.
Yeah, they were 2 weeks short of their fourth birthday when they started in May, and I had heard about them at about 400 miles. I was about 400 miles into my hike, and I heard that they were ahead of me, and being a newspaper reporter, I thought it would be a great daily newspaper story, not just for the trail. So I tried to catch them. And I caught them about 8 or 9 days later. And they were staying at a hostel in Virginia. And a couple women who knew them showed me where they were camped for the night. And I went and talked to her and told her I was a former reporter and I'd like to write about them. And I asked her if I could hike with them for a day and a half, because I thought they were a great story. And she said that would be fine. So the next morning, I met her and the twins, and I hiked with them, and I saw, because I wanted to see how they did it. And her story is she had these twins when she was living in Naples, Florida, and she was a teacher at the time, but she decided to clean houses because she wanted to raise the twins. She also had two other children. She had, at the time, a 10-year-old from a different father and a 20-year-old from a different father. And she'd take the twins on a stroller along the beach in Naples, which is about 10 miles long. And when they got too heavy to take them push them in the stroller, she'd take them hiking on the beach. And she'd read a documentary National Geographic documentary about the trail 6 years before, and she'd always thought that's what she wanted to do someday. And these twins were hiking 6 miles, and then they were hiking 10 miles. And then she had them hike in the soft sand instead of the hard sand, and they could do that. So then she started thinking maybe it was possible to take them on the trail. So she called the Appalachian Trail Conservancy in Harpers Ferry, Virginia, to get the names of other parents that had taken kids on the trail. And none had done it with kids that were three when they started. They're mainly in their maybe 8 to 10. And everybody told her not to do it, except one guy who lived in Delray Beach, Florida, who had thru-hiked it with his 10-year-old, and he told her she might as well try it She had nothing to lose, and if she had to turn back, she had to turn back. And she so she wanted to convince her second husband, at least the father of her 10-year-old, to let him go on the trail, and he said no way. And she convinced him to take the 10-year-old. And so the 20-year-old drove the three of them to the start in Georgia, and he hiked with the three younger children and their two Chihuahua mutts the first 31 miles to where people tend to quit, and then he went back and got the car and picked up the dogs. And she hiked with the three children, the three-year-olds when they started, and the 10-year-old as far as Damascus, Virginia, which is 467 miles. And then the 10-year-old had to leave with his father to go to a sailing camp. She continued hiking with the kids who had turned four on the trail. And what she told me is when she started, at the start, there were lots, most of the people that hiked the trail are recent college graduates. And she said at the end of every day, she was keeping up with the college kids, and they were kind of amazed that she was doing 10 to 15 miles a day. And but eventually the college kids got the trail legs and they took off, and but she kept going. And when I met her, she was at about 621 miles, and she realized that she wasn't going to make it to the end in Maine. But she thought she'd head to Harper's Ferry. So the day and a half I hiked with her, these twins, they basically scampered right along the trail, over the rocks and over the roots. And they were pretty amazing, and they were enjoying it. They had fun. And then the next day, we got to Paris for Virginia, and I took them out for lunch. And then I stopped in a hotel room. I wanted to write their story. And she went out and packed her pack with food for the next several days and came back to my motel room, and I tried to lift her pack, and I thought it weighed about 60 to 70 pounds. And my pack weighed 20 to 30 at that time, and I had a fairly light pack. And then she took off, and I saw her a couple other times because I'd catch her and talk to her for a while. And then she got to Waynesboro, Virginia, where there's a river that you can take to Harper's Ferry, the Shenandoah River, instead of the trail. And she decided to do that to give the kids a different experience, and she'd never canoed before. And there were some rapids where she got dumped in the trail, in the river at one point. But she made it to Harper's Ferry. And then the next year, she went back to Harper's Ferry with the kids who are now five and the 10-year-old who is now 11. And she made it the rest of the way to Katahdin. And when she got there, the twins were five, and the rules at Baxter State Park, where Katahdin is, which is a very steep mountain to climb and very difficult, is that you have to be at least six to attempt this climb. And she told the rangers that she'd come this far and she was not going to not climb Katahdin. So they gave her a special permit, and she made it the first. The Katahdin is a very steep mountain, and it's about 5 miles. And after the first 3 miles, you get to a boulder field that's about 3/4 mile long and very difficult. And she got there, and it was very windy, and the twins started crying, so she turned back. Oh. And she got back to the bottom, and the rangers, who were friendlier now, they told her about another. There's a number of trails that go up Katahdin.
Oh.
And they told her about a trail that was a little easier, so she...
She took it.
She took it, and she made it to the top. And then she went back the next year to Damascus and hiked the trail from Damascus to Harper's Ferry so that they could do the whole trail and the 10-year-old could do the whole trail. So.
Our guest today, Kerry Siegel, his book is titled A Talk in the Woods, Voices Along the Appalachian Trail. Questions for him, give a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking about the book, A Talk in the Woods, Voices Along the Appalachian Trail, with its author, Kerry Siegel. Great to have him with us. The Appalachian Trail Conservancy estimates that 3 million visitors hike a portion of the trail
every year. Most enjoy day hikes and short backpacking trips, but each year a small fraction of those hikers complete the entire trail. How many? Well, since 1936, more than 20,000 hike completions have been recorded by the Appalachian Trail Conservancy, and this includes through hikes and multi-year section hikes. Questions, again, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234 or email to talk at WPR.org. Let's go to Ann in St. Germain. Hi, Ann. Thank you for calling.
Hi there. I just wanted to call because we recently completed a through hike in early September, and we through hiked with our 10-year-old son as a family, and had a fantastic experience, and just wanted to say what a valuable asset the trail is. You know, there's so much you can learn when you're on the trail, you know, from history and geography and, you know, meeting the different people of the different regions and the hikers that are hiking along with you. We hiked northbound this time from Georgia to Maine, and 22 years ago, my husband and I hiked it southbound. And we chose to go northbound this time because, you know, with our 10-year-old son, he's pretty social, and we liked the idea of having more companionship on the trail, which we found as we got further north, it ended up being mostly just the three of us most of the day. So it was just in the early part of the trail when a lot of people are starting out. We had a lot of other hikers that we would pass on a daily basis. But really, once you get up there further north and, you know, further into the hike, it becomes a little bit more of a quiet walk in the woods.
Oh, well, Ann, thanks so much. Comment on that, Carrie?
Well, I think it's great that she did it with a 10-year-old. There aren't that many people with young kids on the trail, but there are others with 10 and in their early teens and single digits. So I think that's great that you did it. And I know she said she did it southbound the first time, which is a very difficult way to do it, depending on when you start. But people start in Maine, going south through Maine in June usually, when it's very wet and very buggy. And so doing that was pretty admirable. It's a tough thing to do.
Yeah, Ann, thanks so much. It sounds like you had a wonderful experience. And thank you for calling. Joel, who's on I-90 heading south. Joel, what's on your mind?
Good day, gentlemen.
Hi.
Just a quick question. Obviously, the foundation of everything for what you're doing is your feet. Because your feet, well, your whole body carries you the whole way, but your feet hit the rubber. What kind of preparation do you do for your footwear? Obviously, you probably maybe go through more than one or two or three. I mean, obviously, the footwear has got to take a beating because your feet are so important.
Yeah.
What can you share with me on that?
Thanks, Joel. That's a good question.
Well, many people wear boots, and many people have to deal with lots of blisters. And I decided I just wear the shoes that I run in every day in Madison, just my regular running shoes, and some people do that. And I had zero problem with blisters the whole way. And I bought 5 pairs of the shoes that I wear, New Balance running shoes, at Movin' Shoes in Madison before I left, and they mailed them to me when I needed a new pair of shoes. And they lasted about 400 to 500 miles per pair.
Yeah.
And I had no problem with running shoes. Some people wear trail shoes. And the advantage of wearing running shoes over boots, aside from not getting blisters, is that they're much lighter.
Yeah.
And wearing a pair of heavy boots on your feet is like carrying an extra 10, 14 pounds of weight in your pack. So,
that makes sense. And this is an interesting aspect of it. You could have things mailed to you, or you could mail things back if you wanted to. There are points along the way, practically every 15 miles or whatever.
Well, maybe a little more than 50 miles, maybe at least every few days, three or four days, you go near a town. And a lot of hikers start with packs that are way too heavy, and they mail a lot of stuff home. And some people have food mailed to them along the way. So, yeah, you can mail stuff home, and you can get stuff mailed to you also.
And the packs, I mean, one guy who was at one of the shops along the way said he had the heaviest pack he ever saw was like 130 pounds or something. But then on the other end, you did write about a guy who had a pack that was like 12 pounds or whatever it was.
Yeah, I met a guy the first morning on the trail, which is one reason I decided to start writing about it, whose pack base weight without food or water was 11 pounds, which was about 9 pounds lighter than mine. And he had a lot of extra light equipment, which I was unaware of when I started, and now it's more common. And so I was interested in what he was carrying. And he was 68, and he was doing it so that he could carry as little weight as possible.
Yeah.
So you can do it with, some people do it with 6 to 8 pounds of base weight without food or water.
Oh. Joel, thanks again. I appreciated the question about footwear, and it made, I tell you what, Carrie, it made a lot of sense to me on the running shoes, a good way to do it. But I can imagine a lot of people thinking, I'm going to need hiking boots, and that can lead to problems if you haven't used them, you know, if you're not used to them, for sure. Dave in Utica, it's your turn. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Very interesting program. Thank you very much. Just a piece of anecdotal information about the growing popularity of the trail. I used to lead groups of high school kids in the Smoky Mountains. And one year I met a woman, this was in the early 2000s, when she graduated college in 1977, 77 people completed the trail. Obviously, that number is much, much higher now. I presume her information is correct. And the other thing I thought I'd add, I did a section hike, and early on, I met a couple with their 9-year-old son. His trail name was Oblivious. And I later learned, and Carrie is aware of all the trail names, I later learned several years later, because I was section hiking the trail, that Oblivious became a triple crowner. In other words, he completed the Appalachian Trail, the Continental Divide, and the Pacific Coast Trail. So there are just all sorts of people out there. It's a wonderful experience. It's not for everyone, but I thought I'd add those two comments.
Oh, Dave, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Carrie, comment?
Well, I'd add about the Triple Crowners that there are some people that do all three trails in 1 year, which is kind of amazing. The Pacific Crest Trail, which is 2,600 miles long, 2,650, and the Continental Divide Trail, which I think it's more than that. I don't remember the distance. But yeah, doing all, but he's right about the trail not being very popular at the beginning. And in the 70s, 783 people did the whole trail, and 1,438 in the 80s, and 3,346 in the 90s, 5,979 from 2000 to 2009. And those are the statistics I'm reading from my book, I know the numbers have continued to grow. So.
Well, Dave, again, thank you very much for calling. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. Stephen Madison called in, couldn't stay with us, but wondering if black bears are encountered along the trail, and is there other wildlife hikers have to kind of watch out for?
Black bears are pretty common, and especially in Great Smoky Mountains National Park and Shenandoah National Park and in New Jersey and in much of the trail. So I saw several black bears, and I saw one black bear with a couple cubs, which is a distance from me. And black bears generally are shy, and they generally run if you see them. I saw one when I was in Pennsylvania, and I was It was late in the evening, and the rain was coming, and I was hiking along a trail, and I saw a bear on the trail several hundred yards in front of me, and I didn't want to stop. So I hiked towards the bear and growled, and it ran away. But the other big wildlife you see on the trail are moose, mainly in Maine, and there are plenty of other smaller wildlife, such as deer.
But the encounters that one would have generally, you know, I don't know if there are stories of attacks. I imagine there were probably some at some point. I mean, you need to be careful. If you're sleeping out on the trail, you need to get your food. If you got food with you, it needs to be up in the air.
Yeah, you're supposed to hang your food in a tree or at some shelters. There are 250 shelters along the trail. And in some of those shelters, there's places to hang your food. And there, you know, I've talked to people that had bear encounters, and I wrote about one couple who were hiking in New Jersey with a dog that was not on a leash, and the dog flushed a bear out of the brush, and the bear started chasing the dog, a small dog. It was a blue heeler. And this couple, they were a couple of in their 20s, they started chasing the bear, and then the bear turned on them and bluffed an attack, and the guy had his hiking stick and his hiking pole, and he broke it, so he'd have a spear point to scare the bear or to attack the bear. And then his girlfriend came, and they both, to make a bigger front, and the bear bluffed, charged them again. And then the dog came back, and then the bear started chasing the dog again. And so they were mostly worried about their dog, so they thought the dog might go to water. So they ran back along the trail and found their dog near a stream. And I met them the day after this had happened. Uh-oh. And by then they'd taken a little trip in the meantime, but they had bear spray and their dog was on a leash. And that's the most, and I met other people who had, bears had come close to them, but then the bears had left. But I think, I don't know of any, there may have been one bear, there were no bear attacks on the trail or no serious injuries or death when I did it in 2014. But there may have been one since, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, interesting. Eric in Middleton, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Eric.
Hi, how are you guys? Good. Hey, I got talked into doing the Smoky Mountain section hike with my much younger son-in-law just this past spring. And I wanted to make two comments. One is, even though I considered myself to be in excellent shape, it was 10 times harder than I thought it would be. The footing was very rocky. At times we felt like we were rock climbing. The elevation, I remember the son-in-law saying, well, don't worry, Pops. It's just the first day coming out of the dam area that's tough. And after that, it's just little ups and downs. Well, that nothing could be further from the truth. It was up and down all 4 days to the point where you got to your shelter and your legs were like gumbo and you collapsed. So I want to tell people, unlike what I consider the horrible movie rendition of the book, A Walk on the Trail, it's tough. And the second point I wanted to make is that on the bears, this past spring, imagine you've done about 10 miles already. You're exhausted, and you got a permit to sleep at one of their sites. It's just an open-air kind of bunk area. And they're closing it. The rangers are closing it because of too much aggressive bear activity. Mm. And you're looking at hiking another 2 or 3 miles to find the next one. So it is a great experience. It was gorgeous. But be prepared, be fit, and call ahead and look at the apps, because your sleeping venue could be closed.
Well, what do you think, Carrie?
Well, I think for many people that start the trail, it is difficult at the start, and it takes a while to get used to it. So he just started at the Smokies, and the climb he was describing is a steep climb. And part of the Smokies is difficult, but it would be difficult for anybody just starting. But once you get going, the Smokies, by the time I got there, was actually pretty easy. But the most difficult part of the trail is in New Hampshire and Maine, where it actually is very difficult, and you are essentially doing almost rock climbing many times because the trail goes straight up a lot of these mountains. But so the Great Smokies is kind of crowded with the shelters because there are many people there because of the national park.
Yeah.
But in most of the trail, especially when I was doing it, behind the big trail bubble, the shelters are not crowded, and it's usually not a problem. But in the Smokies, it would be a problem.
And Jeff Robbins thinks that Eric was talking about the movie was probably a 2015 movie, A Walk in the Woods with Robert Redford. That's probably, I don't know if you saw the movie.
I saw it, and I would agree to him. It was not a very good movie and not a great representation of the trail.
Oh, all right. Eric, you got somebody who agrees with you there. Our guest today is Carrie Siegel, and his book, A Talk in the Woods, Voices Along the Appalachian Trail. And great talking with him today. And you can join in, too, with your own questions or comments. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking about the Appalachian Trail today with Carrie Siegel. His book is titled A Talk in the Woods, Voices Along the Appalachian Trail. Great to have him with us today. And you join in, give us an email to talk at WPR.org, or you can call us at 1-800-642-1234. I want to talk about some of the other people. People hike the Appalachian Trail for a variety of reasons. Some do it to prove themselves. Others that they can overcome difficulties in their lives. And you met one such hiker in Phil Valentine. I think his trail name was Right Click. And an interesting guy. And he was... had something to prove to himself. I guess he had been a substance abuser.
Yes, he was. And I'll read you the first paragraph. I lead every story mainly with people that I write about. But he wrote, Phil Right-Click Valentine says he was shaking, this is in quotes, and quaking in withdrawal from heavy narcotic medication, brutal chemotherapy, and intense radiation treatments in late 2010. When God called him through hike the AT. Right-Click says God whispered, walk the Appalachian Trail. Wait, what, the whole thing, Right-Click replied? Mm-hmm, the whole thing, God replied. When he told Sandy, his wife of 21 years, she thought he was delusional and said, okay, honey, whatever you say, you're so sweet. And Right-Click had never done any hiking or backpacking, but he decided that he was going to do it. He said he wanted to show that recovering alcoholics and drug addicts can do things such as this. And at the time, he was the executive director of the Connecticut Community for Addiction Recovery. And he decided that he asked for time off from his job to do the trail. He decided he was going to do it regardless, but they told him he could take a leave to hike it. And he tried to raise $75,000 for his organization hiking it. And he said, I want to leave a legacy that people in recovery from alcohol and other addiction, people in recovery from cancer, we do survive, and we go on to do extraordinary things. And he was named Right-Click because when he started it, he weighed 254 pounds, he was carrying a heavy pack, and his knee clicked when he hiked. But when I met him, he weighed 200. And the clicking had stopped, and he was no longer taking drugs for his high blood pressure and high cholesterol.
Yeah.
And so he did finish the trail. And
Interesting guy. Rachel in Racine has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Larry. I love your show.
Thank you.
I want to share the fact that as a child, I lived in Massachusetts, my family knew the founder of the Appalachian Trail, Benton McKay. He was the one that dreamed up the theory of hitching all the trails together and going down the spine of the Appalachians.
Very cool. Carrie, are you familiar?
Yeah, but it's correct that Benton McKay was his idea. And the guy primarily responsible for making his idea a reality, his name was Myron Avery. And he was a lawyer in Maine, but the Appalachian Trail became his passion. And that's basically what he did on weekends and free time. And he was the guy that basically kind of mapped the whole trail and measured the whole trail. And he was the first guy to hike it, basically by mapping the trail and measuring it. And he did it before the trail opened in 1937. And basically, the trail became his life until he died of a heart attack. I think it was in 1952. But Myron Avery, it was Benton McKay's idea, but Myron Avery was the guy who basically made his idea a reality.
Yeah, very interesting. Rachel, thanks a lot. Appreciate your call. Skip and Milton, your turn. Hi, Skip.
Well, hi, Larry. Great show. I wish I could have heard the whole thing because it just came on late in it, but... I want to mention my daughter, who was just in her late teens at the time. She did a through hike on the AT in 2009, the wettest season on record for rainfall. At least that's what she was told. And it rained a lot. It rained all the way through Virginia, and that was a challenge. I went out to meet her in the northern part of the hike for just 2 weeks. I was still working then, so I would have liked to hike farther, but anyway, 2 weeks and 171 miles. And it was good weather compared to what she had. We had 2.5 days of snow and only 2 days of rain. So in 2 weeks, that was great weather. She was thrilled. But when I looked at her foot when she were getting ready to climb into the sleeping bags, I noticed her feet looked like Swiss cheese on the bottom. I mean, they were big holes. They were white and big holes. I thought, oh, those are never going to be the same again. But they did heal. It took a while, but her feet just never dried out because it just kept raining and raining and raining. And I hiked the Pacific Crest Trail 50 years ago, and it was in 1976, it was the wettest season, or the wettest August that Seattle had in 40 years. And it rained a lot. We got big storms out of the Gulf of Alaska, and it was cold. It was high 30s and low 40s. It would rain for 4 days and four nights, continuous. And a lot of the cresters going all the way from Mexico were dropping out because it was just...
Too much,
yeah. So... Yeah, weather can really be a challenge. I just want to end with a great book on the PCT, and your guest has probably read it. It's Grandma Gatewood's Walk, and it was, I believe that's the name of it. She was the first woman to thru-hike the AT, and one of the early ones to have done so, and she did it under extraordinary conditions, including a hurricane.
Oh, my goodness. Well, Skip, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. I want to give Richard in Two Rivers a chance to join in. Richard, hi.
Hello, how are you?
Good, appreciate the call.
Yeah, hey, I've done a lot of section hiking, and I'm currently living on the Ice Age Trail, but up here in Two Rivers. I did hike from Asheville to Tennessee up through the Smokies and met some lifelong friends on the Appalachian Trail. It's just amazing, you know, a place where everybody's kind of united in one cause. And I wanted to let people know that the shelters have these things called shelter mice, and I'm certain that they're on the Ice Age Trail too. But they know that these people stop in groups at these shelters, and if you turn on your little nightlight at night, you'll see hundreds of eyes looking at you. It's amazing. They can clear into, they can get into a backpack in seconds and get to your food, chew through the bag, and contaminate your whole day's supply in under a minute.
Shelter mice. And you write about shelter mice in the book.
Yeah, I do. Mice are common, and but you have to hang your pack just not only to keep them away from bears, but to keep them away from mice. And sometimes they run over your head or run over your body if you're in a shelter, but you kind of get used to it.
Richard, thank you so much for calling. You had trail angels. I did want to have you mention that. So many hikers of the Appalachian Trail are the benefactors of food and lodging and shuttle service and other means of generosity from trail angels. Among the people you talk to who live along the trail, who stands out as a trail angel?
Well, one of my favorites was a woman whose name is Marilyn Cookie Lady Wiley. When I met her, I'm just going to read a few lines from my introduction. But it said, after I arrived at her home near the trail in Massachusetts, iconic trail angel Marilyn Cookie Lady Wiley gave me 3 oatmeal chocolate chip cookies, which is what she gave every hiker who stopped. She told me that she'd been giving cookies to backpackers for about 25 years, and she baked them in batches of 150, then froze them and handed out 1,800 by early August when I met her. And she and her husband, Roy Wiley, who was 84, they also let hikers, her home was just off the trail. So they also let hikers camp for free in their yard, and they they had a big blueberry farm, and you could also pick their blueberries, and I pay for my blueberries. But and another guy who I really liked was in Waynesboro, Virginia. The town is about 4.5 miles off the trail, and people from the town would come out and pick hikers up and take them into town. And the guy who started that program picked me up, and he picked me up in his Buick LeSabre. And when I saw him, I asked, "How old are you?" And he was 91. And he was driving back and forth from Waynesboro, picking up hikers and bringing them back. And he had started this program probably 40 years earlier when he saw people coming in and out of Waynesboro to pick up hikers. And another person I really liked was a guy by the name of Ice Cream Man. He was an 87-year-old retired psychiatrist who lived about a quarter mile off the trail in New Hampshire. And he'd put people up in his yard and give them ice cream. And he loved hikers. He loved talking to hikers. And there were a lot of people like that, and those are 3 of my favorites.
Oh, well, I tell you what, the stories of the people that you and we've only touched on just a few. I mean, and I wish we had more time to talk about them. The good thing is they're all available in the book. And how do people get the book?
Well, it's on Amazon, and okay. it's on pretty much every place you wanted to buy a book, you can get it, and it's also on Kindle.
So, Kerry Siegel is the author. Fun talking with him, and his book is titled "A Talk in the Woods," not a walk in the woods, "A Talk in the Woods: Voices Along the Appalachian Trail." It was great fun talking with him today. And great fun having you listening in today. It's always a pleasure to do these shows. And I appreciate him being with us today in person. The shows, they're always a team effort. Our producers, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnod. Our technical directors are Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins. And our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening and stay with us. Lots more in store here on Wisconsin Public Radio News.